Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mai, speech-language pathologist, and I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Hello, Laura. This is Kate Hensler, and I am called a developmental interventionist, and I work with 0 to 3-year-old kids in the First Step program in Kentucky. That's it.
I thought maybe we were going to add another line after that.
I thought I might, but no, that's it.
Oh, okay. Tonight is Thursday, April 16th, and we're going to talk about the same topic that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, and that's receptive language disorders in young children. And if you'll remember, receptive language means how your child understands the words that you use with him, how he follows directions, how he performs little tricks and little routines that you've taught him, as well as all those important milestones that we've discussed, understanding where his nose is, you know, all those body parts, able to find pictures in books, and more importantly, able to understand and participate in conversations and, again, follow directions and daily routines. And so tonight we're going to be talking about more complex words that children learn to understand, typically between 2 and 3 years of age. But if you have an older child who's still having difficulty with these words, don't panic. We're going to teach you some tricks tonight and also talk about some very practical ways that you can work in these learning these kinds of concepts in your everyday routine to help make these words a little bit more meaningful to your children. And tonight we're going to talk specifically about pronouns. And remember from your English classes, pronouns are words that you substitute for names, words like I, you, me, my, and mine are the earliest pronouns that children learn. And again, in typically developing language, they come in somewhere in that between that second and that third birthday. And I think on my test, the Rossetti Infant Toddler Language Scale, and on the Preschool Language Scale 4, those kinds of skills we like to see emerge between 24 months and 30 months. Kate, I always ask you this. Where are pronouns or using early pronouns and understanding early pronouns on the developmental test that you use?
And, you know, one of these weeks I'm going to be prepared for that particular question, but as usual, I'm digging for the Hawaii Early Learning Profile. Sometimes, you know, mine is kind of not as specific as it addresses language,
right.
I do think that is actually fairly specific. So let me get the age.
You look while I blab on and on about it.
Okay.
You know, pronouns are hard to teach, don't you think, Kate?
I do.
I think they're hard to teach. And sometimes I can work myself into a frenzy trying to get a kid to understand the difference between I and you. And that's something that children mess up a lot, even typically developing children, as they're learning the difference between that. And I think the main reason children mess this up is because they are imitating what we model or what we say to them. You know, we will say to them, do you want me to hold you? You know, and so what do they say to us? Hold you? Because they've heard I say that to them, and so instead of kind of reversing that pronoun to say hold me, you know, they just have kind of lifted that little phrase and start to use that there. I've had lots of children really mix up the whole IU thing, and, you know, you'll say, you want some cookies, and so when they want some cookies, they'll say to you, you want some cookies. Children who have difficulty processing language or understanding language with receptive language disorders also mess up pronouns for a little while longer than I think even that you would think, oh, my goodness, we've worked on this in therapy. I don't understand why he's not getting this. I have told him this a bazillion times now, and again, I just want everybody to understand out there, parents, maybe newer therapists, sometimes it takes kids a long time to learn the difference with that. So I, you, me, my, and mine, I think are pretty easy to teach in play, because anybody who's spent about 2 seconds with a two-year-old knows that they are pretty self-centered and really go through that whole, shortly after they turn two, that whole possessive phase takes over. There's probably a bigger name for that than I know, Kate. You might know more cognitive.
I call it the me stage.
Yeah. There may be some kind of more technical name for that out there.
Very normal.
But
yeah, I'm sure Piaget had a term for it, but I call it the me stage. Anyway, to get back to when it's noted on the Hawaii Early Learning Profile, 24 to 30 months uses self-centered pronouns, I, me, and mine. So
yeah,
pretty much right there, right with yours.
Yeah, and that's those are when those typically come in. So if you have a language-delayed child, a child who's having difficulty not only using language but understanding language, you know, he might be 3 or 4, you know, or this might not come in until after 3. So you just want to keep plugging ahead and working on those. And, again, the my or me or mine are pretty easy to teach. I almost always do it with the sign where I pat my chest, you know, and where a child is taking something from me and I'll teasingly grab it back and say, mine, you know, and you only have to do that if the kid is, you know, even sort of with it, they get the whole mine concept
sometimes
pretty easily.
Too well, don't you have parents who say, he says mine all day long?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of normal for that age.
I know, and I like to see that come in. I like to see that little possessiveness and that little me stage start, because that right at that before or shortly after that second birthday, because that lets me think, okay, cognitively, we're chugging along here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what all two-year-olds or new two-year-olds start to want to do. And I had a discussion with a mom about that today. She was telling me, oh, I don't feel like she's making as much progress. I haven't seen her for a couple of weeks, and she said, you know, I just don't feel like she's learned anything new, and that was something that she had started to do in this last couple of weeks, and her birthday was on March 20th, so I said to the mom, you know, how great is this? Right after she's turned two, even though she has a receptive language delay, even though she's not talking really a lot yet, she certainly cognitively is at this phase and has learned that, because she did not want to give up any toy today that she was holding. Boy, she would take the bubbles and turn her back to me, and I would try to reach around her and tease her and say, mine. And, oh, she would, you know, really get into screaming, me, my. And we had a really good time with that. So that's how I teach those, is really to act like I'm taking a toy from a child, or when they want something from me, you know, I'll pull it back and say, no, mine. And that's often the first kind of sequenced little set of words that I get, the no, pause, mine. You know, that lets me know, we're getting closer to phrases when you can sequence those two words. And don't you think those are among the first two words that you hear kids try to sequence like that?
Yeah, or my blank, you know, same sort of concept. Yeah, I agree that me and mine or my are pretty easy. I don't know. They seem pretty obvious, and it's easy to make them playful, and it's almost like instinct. You know, it comes along pretty easily.
It does.
The other ones, not so much.
I know. And your point last week about words being easy to say, me, my, and mine, because that's just, you know, an initial M, which is typically one of the first consonant sounds that children can produce. It's an easier word to say, too.
Mm-hmm.
So you can usually get that one pretty well, pretty easily. I have had a couple of parents, though, and again, these would be the same parents that I've been talking about for the last few weeks that have, you know, been really overdoing the whole disciplinary thing and have said to me, oh, we don't use the word mine in our house. And I think, oh, please don't let me not teach that. You know, please let me have something here, because it is such a developmentally appropriate concept, and I want children to defend their possessions and stuff. And I think that's on your test, Kate, on the Hawaii Early Learning
Profile.
Oh, yeah. Defends possessions. You know, you don't want them to be so passive at preschool and everybody take their toys, or, you know, have their own cup when they're at a little play date and a kid walk up and yank their cup. You want them to be able to defend their possessions and say, you know, mine, and you know, use those kind of power words to communicate that message. I don't want kids that are run over and that can't verbally fight back with other kids. All right. let's move on to talking about the hard pronouns to teach, I and you. And typically, again, you just have to model that or say that in a way that the child would say it. I usually always start with snacks with this when we're working on this, and I'll have a parent or another sibling be there, and, you know, I'll do the whole who wants a cookie, and I really have the other people model, I do, I want a cookie, so that a child hears that. And I really try to teach myself or catch myself when I'm saying, do you want this, do you want that, and try to model the whole who thing, so that they're not constantly hearing you as in the phrase or the sentence, so that they don't, you know, especially with kids that are a little bit echolalic or that imitate everything. I really want to model it and say it like they would want to say it. Our other trick, Kate, is one that I'm sure others, more professional speech pathologists and more black and white speech pathologists would cringe at, but when I have children who are really struggling with the pronoun I really do point to my real eye, my eyeball, and say I, because they typically already know that word and it's a visual cue that makes sense to them. I think other purists would, you know, say you should really do the sign language for that and point to your chest or some way, but if a kid's really struggling, I just think boil it down and make it easy and, you know, point to your eye and say it, because more than likely he already has that word. And I think you do the same thing, Kate.
I do. I crossed that bridge a lot. I did once get my hand slapped by one of those more purist-type speech therapists. She said, I would never sign it like that. The problem with the real sign for I as a possessive word is too hard. You know, and it's not, doesn't make as much sense. So I boil down so many signs that I kind of feel like, what's one more? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, and it's not a permanent system. And even children who pick up that little cue, haven't you had children who then start to do it themselves, children who are really good signers and who sign mm-hmm. lots of other things? Or when I've really had to over-exaggerate it to teach it, I will have kids that really poke themselves in the eye for a while they're saying it. But that goes away. That totally right. goes away. So it would not be a reason for me not to teach it
right
that way. And I think if you have a child that's struggling, you know, any kind of cue that you can give them and help them, help make it more concrete or more black and white to them rather than just leaving it so abstract. Okay, do we want to say anything more about that, the whole IU thing? Oh, do you know what I do all the time with teaching you is that I tell kids for them to do something, and that it's the whole, you do it, you, and, you know, I'm really pointing at them. I think that's in one of my DVDs, and maybe it's in Teach Me to Talk, and it might be in Teach Me to Listen and Obey, too, in the whole pronoun section. But kids really like that little game, too, where I'm telling them to clean up. I say, you clean up, and if they look at me, I say, no, you do it, you, and they think that's hysterical.
Same
you know,
as
I'm really,
mind game, yeah. They see, and you're pointing at them. A lot of times I'll use two hands, you do it, and they do the same, you know, they're doing it back before you know it.
Right, and they think it's hysterical. And if you can, again, make it part of your routine and make it fun, they're more than likely going to pick up on that and really enjoy it and think it's a blast and want to do that. Some resources that I read when I was doing the research for Teach Me to Listen and Obey 2 really say to repeat your name, like, I, Laura, want the bubbles, or you, Tyler, blow the bubbles, to really do the whole repetitive name thing. That's a recommendation, but I don't really do that. Do you, Kate?
No.
I don't really teach it that way, but that's another recommendation that you can do. And again, if I had a child that was really struggling with that, I might do it. That's something I might try. But certainly if you have a child that is echolalic, meaning that they really repeat what they hear you say, do not model. Do not do lots of the you want it, you do it, that kind of thing, until they really have mastered I. And again, with those children, the way that you teach any kind of language is that you say it how they would say it. So you model, you know, I want you to, so that they repeat, I want you to, and that does really become pretty habitual pretty quickly with those kinds of kids.
Right. Sometimes I will say, if I'm doing the whole you do it, you do it, I might stop and say, Tyler, do it, you know.
Right.
But then I go back to you do it. No, Tyler, do it, you know. But I
me
don't
too.
Say you, Tyler. To me, that just doesn't sound like
normal.
Normal. It just doesn't sound like something I would ever say to a two-year-old, and so it sounds really contrived and kind of goofy to me. And
me
so,
too.
But I would say, you do it, you do it, you, you. And if that's not getting, I say, you know, I might say, not Kate, in a real exaggerated
right.
way, Tyler, you, Tyler. Again, really playful, but not you, Tyler. You know, sounds like we're
yeah.
going to take an oath or something. I don't know. I just don't like the ring of that or the lack thereof. So, no. But I will sometimes try and say their name, but just make it a short phrase.
Me
but
too,
think,
and I've reworded it.
Right.
Yeah, so that
right.
they understand it. Yeah.
I think the most important thing, like you said, is to just model it the way you would hope that they would say it.
Yeah.
You know, and not do a lot of, I want this and you want that, because they do tend to get confused on those. So.
They do. And for kids, and when I first hear them start trying and messing that up, again, that's my little clue, oh, we need to work on this. This is something he's struggling with, so I've got to figure out how to teach it. And I model it a lot, but again, I really like the idea of having someone else be that model for that. And I really will sit there and even really kind of whisper coach to a mom and say this, and have her really model lots of those things like we want the child to repeat. And that works well. Older siblings that are just a little bit older, say if you're working with a two-year-old on this and you have a 4 or 5-year-old little brother or sister, if they're not too bratty, boy, can they be a big help with teaching these kinds of things, because so many times that toddler's going to want to imitate what brother or sister have said to get the fun snack or the toy or the turn. And so that's a good way to do it, too. I use brothers and sisters in therapy all the time.
Yep.
If they're not too possessive with those toys.
When they're the types who will play the game, and some will play it beautifully, and others, you know, it's just they're
not so great. Yeah.
Right, not flexible enough to be coached through it, and so it becomes a, you're having a power struggle with the 4 or 5-year-old along with the 2-year-old. But, yeah, if it's an agreeable kid, they can be the great best model, because kids normally do love to imitate their big sister or big brother, so don't be afraid to use them.
Right, and again, let me just go back to my earliest point about this. Pronouns are really hard to teach, so don't beat yourself up if you're having difficulty as a mom or dad with this at home, or even a new therapist. It just takes messing it up, 400 or 500 times before you finally realize, okay, every time I've said that, he did not learn it this way, so I need to figure out a better way to do that. And so just keep playing around and kind of teaching yourself how to model that. So that your child can learn it. And I have a little guy that so struggled with that, and we worked on that for months and months and months, and then it just clicked. I haven't had a problem. He hasn't had a problem using pronouns in a long time, the I, the you, and mixing that up. So just keep hammering away with that, and they'll get it. Some children, older children too, that are, say, 4 or 5 or 6, and might need more visual cues, again, with those sentence strips that you use with the picture exchange communication system with children that are way more advanced than the kids that you or I usually see, Kate, that are, you know, 2-year-olds. If you have a much older child, or if you have a child who's hyperlexic, or, you know, their strength, their cognitive thing really is reading, I know some of the literature on autism talks about really using those visual cues, those written words, is a visual cue too. But I don't ever see them at that age. They've moved on to another speech pathologist from me, since I am an early interventionist. So that might be an idea for some older kids too. All right, and let me just say one other thing about pronouns. The gender pronouns, he, she, him, and her, usually come in around 36 months, so shortly before that third birthday. And I talk about boys and girls for a long time and then kind of do, the boy wants to do it, he wants to swing, or it's the girl's turn, she wants to slide, and really mix it in and teach those gender pronouns where I'm modeling boy, girl, and then the correct pronoun for a long time before I start expecting a child to say that or know that. And the other thing that I did a long time ago when I used to keep kids a little longer than I do now, is really use like catalogs of like Land's End or something when you have lots of pictures of boys and girls, and you can say, she's wearing red shoes. What is she wearing? And really have lots of opportunities to hammer those pronouns home. You probably don't do much with gender pronouns, huh, Kate?
Not really specifically targeting pronouns. I do, as kids get closer to three, sometimes try and work on boy and girl, the concept,
yeah.
You know, which is the boy,
yeah,
and which is the girl, but I don't really, that's a little specific language stuff for me to really get too into that. I mean, sometimes I see it come in and I think, oh, he has that.
Right. And it's a surprise. You think, oh, I didn't even have to work on that. You know, what a bonus. We didn't spend weeks and months working on that. And again, boy and girl, they have to have that prerequisite concept of understanding gender before you would ever start to really focus on those pronouns. So if you're starting to do that, make sure that your child can adequately understand boy and girl. And again, the best way to do that, you know, would be using books or little toys or something where you've got lots of boys and girls, and you might separate them into groups. You might have obviously girl characters and obviously boy characters, and say, we're going to put all the girls in this group and all the boys in this group. You know, and with my own kids and with kids that I think are working on the gender thing, you know, I'll say, is mommy a girl or a boy? Is Lara a girl or a boy? Now, how many boys do you say, do you use that question with kids, Kate? Because so most of my little boy friends always think I'm a boy, and I think, oh, that's such a good compliment to me. They think I'm their little friend. And then we mess it up and say, no, I'm a girl, I'm like mommy. But it's you have to teach the boy-girl concepts first before you can move on to those gender pronouns. And gender pronouns,
I always do a lot of mommy's a girl and daddy's a boy, you know.
Right.
Usually I'm working with boys, so, you know, you're like daddy. I do a lot of that. I saw a little child, shall we say, in a daycare today, and I almost said, are you a girl or a boy?
You didn't know, huh?
He was dressed like a boy, but he had pretty blonde hair past his shoulders.
Oh.
And I really was thinking, well, the clothes say boy, but the hair definitely says girl. I finally said, what's your name? And it was Ethan. So I knew.
Boy, ding, ding, ding. I know.
Just a little aside there. He had very long blonde hair. So.
Oh, you weren't seeing him. He was a
No. I was in the classroom. I was following the First Steps model today and stayed in the classroom, and he was there visiting me, and I wanted to know secretly whether he was a boy or a girl. So, are you like mommy or are you like daddy?
I think you did the right thing by saying, what's your name? That was the better way to do it.
Then I couldn't really understand, and I had to ask the teacher, what's his name? Because he was saying Ethan Alexander.
Oh, so you couldn't even tell by the name. Yeah.
I said, what? I asked him about three times, and he was answering, but the Alexander was a mouthful for him. I said, okay. Anyway, that's not relevant. I just thought it was funny.
We're tired today, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Thursday. Okay, I think that's about enough talking about pronouns. What do you think?
I'm good with that.
I think we've talked about that. Now let's move on to talking about adjectives and adverbs. And if you'll remember from your English classes and your studies on grammar, that means descriptive words or words that we use to talk about the characteristics of something. And I always, when I'm talking about this with parents, I tell them to think about opposite words: cold, hot, big, little, wet, dry, fast, slow, yucky, yummy, those kinds of words that describe things. Colors also fall into the descriptive word category, but I just beg parents not to overdo the whole colors thing and really not to fall into that trap to move on and teach all the hundreds and hundreds of other kinds of descriptive words before they really start hammering those colors.
I think we're both sensitive to the colors because we've had too many kids who get really hyper-focused on colors, and that's, you know, you say, what is it? And they say, green! And, you know, you're going for shoe or ball or hat or baby.
Well, and parents get hyper-focused on those darn colors, too, and lo and behold, so do some therapists.
Yes, and that's true.
Yeah, you know, and it reminds me of that little guy that I saw just briefly from, say, December to about February, and he had about 20 words, and I think 10 of them were colors and 10 of them were numbers. He didn't have any.
Let me guess, three were the replacement therapist?
I was the replacement therapist.
But why?
But, you know,
okay, I need
oh,
to.
Oh, that
I
is so funny me. Today. Okay.
Yeah.
But they had overdone it, and Mom and Dad had done that too. And oh, let me say, if he had 10 more words, they were letters of the alphabet. You know, that's a big surprise to you, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they had really overdone that, and you really would ask this little boy, what is this or what's that? And he always responded with the color rather than the name of the object. And his parents were really proud of that until I started saying, that's great, but where are all these other words? You know, I'm glad he understands colors, and, you know, it turned out that the speech pathologist really wanted to do colors and overemphasize that, too, because it was something that he liked, but they all went a little bit overboard with that. And I do like to use colors. Colors are a good thing to use when kids are trying to go to phrases if, again, that's kind of their obsession and they know it and they're focused on it. That's probably the only time that I would ever really do colors and really try to where I would, you know, spend more than half a second talking about a color. It would be if a kid, you know, if I'm trying to get him to say phrases and we can't get anything but blue ball, well, boy, I'll take blue ball at that point. But I don't focus on colors too much. Understanding colors or being able to receptively point to colors is on the preschool language scale at a 36-month level. So it is a developmental skill kids need, but not to the exclusion of everything else. And I do think it's something that parents can get stuck on because, one, it's obvious and it's kind of easy to teach. But if you have a kid who has less than, say, 100 words, I wouldn't even start with those darn colors yet and would really focus on words that he needs to make a big difference in his everyday life instead of color words. All right, have I been on the soapbox about that enough tonight?
Well, I guess, but we do like that is one of our soft spots. We really don't love that. I think I understand parents think it's like
they think it looks smart.
Right. For lack of a better term, they want to teach, quote unquote, teach your child something, and so they work on those academic things. And as Laura said, if a child has 10 or 20 words, really, what does green or red or blue do for them, you know, as opposed to mine or hot or eat or drink or bye-bye or some word that changes their little life that they really have some control. And two-year-olds, like the rest of us, really do want some control. And some words will do that, and colors don't really do much of any of that. So.
Yeah, not so much on the colors.
No.
Okay. Other
I like the 100-word thing, though. That's a good way to think of it. If your child isn't using 100 words spontaneously, then don't sit around teaching colors because they're not ready.
They're not ready. Yeah, and that gives parents and therapists kind of a black-and-white guideline. Okay, we're only at 30 words. We don't need to be messing with those colors yet. Other important descriptive words to teach are words, they're called physical state words, and it's like hungry, thirsty, tired, sleepy. And again, children should understand these words far earlier than they're able to say these words or use these words. But kids should understand what those words mean and then what would come after, like the baby's hungry. She's so hungry. We need to feed her. And that's exactly how you teach those physical state words, is that you use it in the context of why teaching the, oh gosh, I've just forgotten what that's called. I'm having word-finding difficulties in addition to being tired today. Teaching, okay, what am I trying to say? You don't know, do you?
No.
Sorry. Okay, we'll come back to that. It will probably come to me before 7 o'clock, but if not, it'll probably come before next week. So I'll go back and explain that then. But you're wanting to teach the concepts like sleepy, you know, the baby's tired, she needs to go to bed, or she's sleepy, what does she need to do? She needs to go to bed. So you're going to teach it like that. Other kinds of words that fall into this category are words for feelings, happy, sad, mad. Kate, your all-time feeling word, scary. That would be one of those, some of those words too. And again, these are words that they're not going to be in a child's first 50 words probably, but that you do need to start looking at those kinds of words as a child wants to express more complex feelings, and certainly after he's using and understanding phrases, then you're going to want to move on to include some of those. And understanding those kinds of words, again, are a 36-month skill. So if you have a child that's not following basic directions yet or even two-step directions, which would be a 24-month skill, you're not going to want to teach those words until later. Let me digress for a little bit. Excuse me. So many children that have autism, and Kate, I don't think we've ever talked about this, but a lot of the floor time theory, you know, floor time is Dr. Stanley Greenspan's approach to, I think now they, instead of calling it floor time, they call it the DIR model, the, oh, what's DIR stand for? Oh, my gosh, I'm falling apart. What does it stand for? Do you know today? Boy, we're hitting
like
a new low on the show, aren't we?
I can't think of it either. I still call
okay,
it
anyway,
time.
Whatever. The DIR model, it really stresses that children with autism don't always know how to label their feelings or have a wide range of affect. And so you're going to want to teach those words and teach those feelings pretty early. And so oftentimes when a therapist has been floor time trained and they're so entrenched in that, I see them working on those kinds of words, again, way before I think a child is developmentally ready language-wise, and that's a little bit frustrating to me. I don't know. I don't think we've ever talked about this, have we, Kate?
No.
I can't believe it because there's so few things we haven't talked about. But there's one OT in town that really does that a lot, and I think that's great to build the foundation for understanding it, but I get a little miffed when I go in and there the mom is talking about that the OTs, you know, wants to use some signs or use some pictures that represent those words. And I think, oh, my gosh, we're still working on milk and juice. You know, we can save happy and sad for way down the line because we're not even sort of ready for that. And so, again, that kind of, when you look at teaching those words from a language perspective, those are things that emerge closer to the three-year-old level. So if you have a child that's functioning at 24 months, save that for later. And you'll get there. You're just not ready to do it yet.
I think the thing with those is they're fairly abstract. You know, it's not the simplest concept, even though, you know, it's fairly automatic to get mad and perhaps even happy. But to understand, it's really kind of higher level. And
yeah, it's pretty complex, like you said, and pretty abstract. And so I certainly agree with why we would want to do it, but looking at some kids from a language perspective, we had a little guy that we shared with this OT, and she did that with, after the, I'm not going to say the name on here today, but I'm going to call you about that later, because I don't know if you remember her, them using that book that talked about happy hands and sad, or mad hands, and all this, do you remember that, with the whole... Okay, I'll have to call you and refresh your memory on that. And I remember talking to that mom who was a pediatrician and saying, okay, this is why this is not a good idea, and this is why this is not working, because he is nowhere near that level language-wise, and this really is a language concept in addition to an emotional concept.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I've digressed once again. Let's talk about adjectives that we teach a lot. I think big and little, I teach that all the time because those are size words. And again, Kate, I think that's a big cognitive concept, and that probably is on the test that you use, your developmental milestone checklist.
Yes, I do lots of big and little. It's, again, not as abstract, pretty easy to see, and I use the more kind of, you know, you don't want something that's only marginally bigger than the little one. You want something pretty obvious, you know. I'll use like a big spoon and a little spoon and a big daddy and a little baby, and I talk about big and little. And I think, Laura, I just want to say this for those of you who are listening thinking, teach it, teach it, teach it. What do you mean by that, teach it, teach it? And I think, just let me say, when I'm quote-unquote teaching these things, a lot of times really all that really looks like in practice or in play, as the case may be, is that I'm aware of using those words and focusing on those ideas a lot. And that I just might say, get the big spoon, get the little spoon, look, oh, or if they grab a spoon, I might say, you got the big spoon, so that I'm kind of reminding myself or trying to be aware to work those concepts in, not to sit and say, get the big spoon. Where's the, you know, where's the little spoon? I mean, not to say I don't ever do that, but that is once I've done lots and lots and lots and lots of just working that into our play so that they've had many, 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 many opportunities to see and to experience those various concepts. And so when we're teaching it, a lot of times what we're really doing is playing it, but reminding ourselves, oh, yeah, he did not seem to understand when, you know, last week I said get the little one, he grabbed the big one. So I'm going to work big and little back in to
do it over and over, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just heard you do this, and I'm sure you're aware that you're doing it when you're teaching it, but I do change my voice when I say it. I say, oh, it's big.
Yeah.
It's so big. Whoa, get the big one. Oh.
And then it's little.
I know, and I'm going to make myself choke today. I need some water with this. I've had the Cookie Monster voice going too much today.
Uh-oh. Quit too many Cookie Monster games.
Yeah, but, you know, that is something you can do, too, and that gives your child a little another cue as to what you're talking about, and I'm constantly using my hands with that. You know, I'm holding my hands out way spread apart and saying, it's big,
and I have so many kids. I just kind of reach, like, you know, I take both hands and stretch them as far out as I can to each side, and don't you have so many kids who do that? Really, before they understand big, they just think it's kind of funny to do, and they're saying,
big.
Yeah, they like that one. And even the little sometimes, but big is better.
Big is better. And I have a little girl right now who's very apraxic, and she does it with her voice when she's saying, and then she'll say, you know, for little. And she's not making combining the correct consonants and vowels for the word. You know, it's for big and for little, and I think it's so cute. It's just adorable. I wish I had that on video. I wish when we were filming that DVD, she was doing that. You know, I really do, after I've said it, though, a lot and really labeled things like that, I really do set up situations in play where I'm asking, though, which one is big and which one is little. And I do this all the time with my baby doll set because I've really taken great lengths to find a hat that's big and a hat that's little and a spoon that's big and a spoon that's little. And so I use it with those darn baby dolls all the time when I'm teaching that. And in my DVD, Teach Me to Listen and Obey 2, there's a long section about teaching size. But I really do have those opportunities where I'm saying which one is big or little. And again, in the context of play, or the baby says, no, that's too big. I want the little juice. I want the little bottle. You know, and really, again, work that into play. But I probably do set it up a little bit more structured than you do in that context after I've, quote unquote, taught it and used it a whole lot of times to see if they understand it.
Right. No, I do that, but I just wanted to make sure that we said, you know, because I think when we say we teach it, I don't want people to think we're sitting around with the flashcards or the
at a table,
photocopies of a big spoon and a little spoon, and we're saying, point to the big spoon, because teach, you know, even though we do think in those terms, really we play it and to remind people that kids really, especially kids with receptive language concerns or issues, really need to see it and to see it and hear it many, 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 many times. So
and we talked about that last week, and I think the several weeks ago when we were talking about using language in your daily routines, that you in the bathtub you're not going to say "Where's the duck?" if you have not shown and told and said "duck" 500 times, 500 baths before, you wouldn't really start out automatically asking "Where's the duck?" if you had not spent lots and lots of time, quote unquote, teaching it in the context of play.
Ladies, we have a caller.
Oh, I'm so excited! I was just thinking we didn't give out the call. Talk about the call-in number, but somebody called in anyway.
Great.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Are you there?
Yes. I was just calling in to listen. I was enjoying everything that you're saying. I'm actually out here walking with the baby in the snuggly right now, and I was laughing because. You know, how she was talking about the big and the small. Like, I can tell when she, as you can hear her now, probably.
Yeah.
See, I think she's saying that this is, I want to talk too. I want to chime in as well. but the question, this is Spike Spielberg. I'm a host here on Blog Talk Radio as well. And I wanted to, I guess I can ask a question now that you've opened up the microphone. So at what particular point, or what can you do to start to communicate? I've heard some people, you know, doing sign language with the babies and things like that to help them communicate a little bit better. But, I mean, at what point, like, I mean, should she start to formulate words? She's already saying that, which I really
like. And that's
like.
Your favorite one, isn't it?
I like that one. So,
how old is she, Spike?
She is 10 months.
Yeah. You know, you can use signs with babies, and the experts recommend that parents start to really sign with babies between 6 months and 12 months. And if you'll go to my website at teachmetotalk.com, there's a whole category of articles about how to use sign language with your baby, some tips to use, and there's actually an article there that lists the most common signs and the ones that are easiest to teach and work into your daily routines. And experts tell us that signs are a great way to help babies learn to communicate before they're even physically ready to start to use those words. But by about the time a child has their first birthday, they usually have a word. Like that one word vocabulary is pretty pretty normal for a baby turning one. And you said your baby already has that word with dada, so that's great.
And
then by the time a child is about 15 months old, we want them to have about 8 to 10 words that they would use or say on their own, and certainly signs. Experts tell us and research tells us sign language helps babies build their vocabularies again, so that would be an excellent way. Other things that you could be doing with her right now are really, really labeling things and talking about things and going out of your way to show her things. And just using really simple single words so that when you're playing ball, you're saying ball and showing it to her and playing with it and really talking about what she's paying attention to and really helping her learn to associate words with the people and with the events and the actions that are happening around her every day.
Well, she likes the phone, and I think she really has gotten a handle on this text messaging thing. I know, it's scary already, right?
As the mothers of teenagers, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you're in for it if she's doing it now. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And, I mean, I'll just continue to listen in. You guys are rocking here today.
Oh,
well,
thanks so much. Thanks for calling in. Bye.
That was cute.
That was cute. He's a cute dad. That was cute. He had the baby right there.
Yeah, you could hear her in the background. She was babbling. Sounds good.
That was cute. Our call-in number for anybody else who wants to call in is 1-718-766-4332. And we'd love to have you call in. And I was just thinking, I don't think I gave that number out at the beginning of the show tonight, which I typically do. Okay, we were just talking about descriptive words. Let's see. Tonight we were also going to start to talk about asking and answering questions. And this is something that I get lots of questions about on the website. And learning to answer questions sometimes is, parents sometimes think about that as an expressive language problem, or they can't really formulate the answer in order to respond. But I really have started to think about not being able to answer questions more as a receptive language problem, as they don't really understand the question. What do you think about that, Kate?
Well, as always, I tend to side with you on that, but I do think that is where a lot of times I begin to see the receptive language issues really coming out. You know what I mean? They've
right.
got to the, they label things, they seem to understand that and use that fairly effectively, but then I'm asking them simple questions using words that I've heard them use, so I assume, well, they're going to get this, but then I look, and I mean, based on how they respond, I think, maybe not. Maybe I assumed wrong, you know, that they really, that's where a lot of times I really start to become aware, okay, there really is a receptive language problem, yeah. So I agree. To me, it has more to do with they didn't necessarily, and it's confusing somehow because on one level I think, well, if they could use that word spontaneously and appropriately, surely I could turn around and ask a simple question with it and they're going to understand it, but that's not really all the time the case.
Yeah, it's not. And let me give you kind of some other problems or other signs that a child might be having receptive language problems, which would lead us, which really would be kind of the root of not being able to answer a question. These are things that kids with receptive language problems that have difficulty answering questions do. Instead of answering the question, they repeat the last few words of the question rather than answering it. So you might say, "How old are you?" And they say, "Old are you?" Or you say, not necessarily a question like, "Do you want to read a book?" You know, "Do you want to play choo-choos or read a book?" You know, they might say, "Read a book," and then they're mad when you start. When they say, "Read a book," and then you start reading the book and you realize, oh, no, you just said that last one that you echoed the last few words of that question. Another sign might be that they answer incorrectly, such as you ask them, you know, "Do you want milk or juice?" And they just start shaking their head yes, meaning I want something, but I'm not sure what you said after that. They might give an off-target response so that you ask them a question and they give an answer that's totally unrelated. This happens all the time. Again, back to the age thing. "How old are you?" And they say their names. Or you ask them, you know, their names and they say, "Two!" And you think, oh, your mom's been working on those questions with you and you haven't quite sorted out which answer goes with that question, have you?
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be a child who just doesn't respond or totally ignores the question. So many times parents will say, "Oh, he just didn't want to answer you. He's just choosing to ignore you." And I think that's not it at all. He doesn't understand what I've asked him to do, or he doesn't understand the question. And let's talk about kind of the norms, what children should be able to do with answering questions. Between 1 and 2 years, children should look in the appropriate place when asked a simple question like, "Where's Daddy?" He should start to look to Daddy when you ask that question, long before he's able to say, "He's right there." He should be able to look over when you're asking that, or anything like that. You know, "Where's Kitty Cat? Where's your book? Where's your milk?" He should be looking in the direction. That gesture would be his answer to that. By 2 years, children should be able to make a choice of two. You know, again, do you want to play choo-choos or read a book? And especially when you're holding both of those up, a child should be able to point to it or get it or in some way let you understand that he wants that. And, Kate, haven't you had children who you can't believe that you're sitting there and they're older than two and can't make a choice yet?
And you're saying, "Milk or juice?" And they're saying, "Milk or juice?"
Yeah. Pick one. Yeah.
I always say, pick. And then if they finally reach for one, I say, "Oh, you picked juice." Yeah, you know, but
right.
Yeah, they just don't seem to really understand to make your saying choose, pick, you know, it's milk
right.
or juice. And they.
And when I have a kid like that, I always think, okay, he needs more of a cue here to what I'm talking about. So I always try to hold up the choices that I'm giving him. And I start doing choices with kids on in the assessment, not even a few weeks down the road in therapy. You know, in the assessment, I'm giving them a choice with, you know, are we going to play balls or bubbles, and holding up the ball toy and holding up the bubbles and hoping in some way that they start to really lean toward it, reach for it, you know, look at one and smile and, you know, act like they want to do it. You know, that lets me know that they've made that choice. So, but it is surprising to me with, and it's those kids that we call processing kids, but really they're kids with receptive language problems. Those are the ones that have the hardest time making the choices, don't you think?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And I do see that a lot, way beyond when I think I should. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, yeah. It doesn't always make sense with their still struggling with that when I think, well, they should get that.
Yeah,
that,
and they may be even imitating lots of words and even
mm-hmm.
using lots of words, but still not be able to choose between two different activities. And so, again, I'll show that to moms sometimes. We have a little guy that we share right now, too, that the mom and I had to really show that to her, and she's not a mom who participates in the session all the time because he's this little guy that we see has an older, very active brother who just totally takes over if he's in the room. So she's a mom that kind of is in and out, or mostly out, and kind of comes in at the end. And, you know, I remember talking to her about this when I first started to see this little guy and say, you know, watch this. He can say both these words, but look what he does when I give him a choice. And she was kind of surprised by that, too. But then it made her see that when she's asking him a question at dinner, you know, what do you want for dinner tonight, mac and cheese or chicken? Well, good grief, if he can't make a choice between the bubbles and the balls when I'm holding them right in front of his face, he is not going to be able to make that choice later when it doesn't make much sense, when he doesn't have those objects right there in front of him to choose. So that's always interesting to me when I have a kid who isn't doing that yet. So I just think, you know, I've got to really work on it and really show them the choices in addition to telling them. And sometimes you have to help them make the choice.
Yeah,
you have
sometimes
to.
Showing doesn't even really seem to make it clear. And that one I really don't necessarily understand, except to say I know it's not that uncommon. You know, I don't see any obvious response. And I'm saying, pick, look, juice
yeah.
or milk. And it's kind of like, you're overwhelming me. I don't get it. I don't even understand, honestly, why it's so difficult. But for kids with receptive language issues, it is.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, what I do in that situation is really try to use then a preferred thing, a thing that they really, really like, and something I know that they hate.
Right.
So that you can really teach, oh, boy, you better pick the one that you better look at the one you really want, because guess what? We're playing with that sock unless you say choo-choos or unless you reach out and grab those choo-choos. We're sitting here with the sock for 2 minutes until you come up with something better. Or kids that are echolalic or always repeat your last choice no matter what, that's how you really teach that they better say or pick or somehow indicate that they want or sign. Pick the first choice is that you give them something they love and you say that option first, and then you say something that they might not like as much second to be sure that they're picking that. And I do that with snacks. If I know that I have a snack food that they don't like, I'll always have that as the last option so that if they say that one, I make them take it, and then hopefully that really starts to become painfully obvious to them, uh-oh, I said the wrong one. And so, you know, or then I might really, you know, I'm not going to shove it down their throat to make them eat it or anything, but, you know, they do, when they're getting upset, I'll say, you said so-and-so, that so-and-so, and then really say, oh, you must mean whatever the snack is that they really like, and have them try to imitate it or reach for it or something other than just imitating that last thing that they heard. And for some kids, it takes even weeks of doing that before they really understand, I better not just pop out that last word that she said.
Right. And I really think I've had, I don't know, certainly kids who are echolalic or just kind of automatically repeat back what they hear, but even kids who aren't, I don't really consider echolalic, but they've been in therapy for a while and they've learned the Kate says it, I say it game, which of course
right.
we do want them to learn because we're trying to teach them to talk, but then they almost overlearn that and they've learned
right.
to imitate, which is part of the plan. But so I almost always offer the thing I assume they're going to want or the correct answer. If I'm giving them a choice of two answers, I almost always give them the right answer first. So
yeah.
that I think it encourages them to kind of slow down and listen, whether they're echolalic
yeah.
or they have receptive language issues, or because so often we do kind of create these kids who imitate, and, you know, they just
yeah.
pop it right back at us. And it's like, well, we really need them to be listening to what we're saying and really kind of understanding and slowing down enough to think about it a second. So I tend almost always give. And I keep waiting for the kid who figures that out, that Kate always gives me the best choice or the right answer first.
First, yeah.
I have not had one yet, really. I don't know why.
Oh, I really have, and I have had
have
good luck
you?
With that. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it takes a little while. A little guy that I see now that I've worked with a long time that's over three that I still see, I used that method with him for a long time. And let me tell you, we had some fits on the floor when I would give him the second item. And again, I'm not doing that to be mean to him or purposefully make him mad, but you do want to give it to them and have them start to realize, oh, and then offer that first choice, you know, and present it back again. And his mother got really, really consistent with that, and that got a lot better with this little guy. With doing that choice thing where we gave him the thing he really wanted first, we said it first, and then he got to the point, it was so cute, he would interrupt us before we could finish, you know.
Giving him the wrong answer,
yeah.
he would stop you and say,
yeah.
I'm not
you
falling
know,
for that one again.
You want to play choo-choos or do puzzle? He would say, choo-choo, before I could even get puzzle, you know, or whatever it happened to be. You know, he would jump in. You know, he learned,
got
oh,
it.
I better get it out right now.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I've had kids who did learn to slow down and listen and respond. You know, they did process what I was saying and answer appropriately. But I haven't had one where, sounds like that guy truly figured it out.
He
knew you were going to give. I don't know that I've had one that I thought, oh, he knows what I'm doing. I've had one that I think, come on, you've got to get this because I've done it 10,000 times.
Yeah. You know, and what I'll do in that case is I'm the one I want them to pick. I'm shaking it right in front of
mm-hmm.
their faces. I'm holding that non-preferred item back so that I'm, you know, or I might even whisper it,
mm-hmm.
you know, thinking, oh, for heaven's sake, please say the first one. Don't just say the second one. Don't just
don't
pick the thing you don't want.
Better. And like you said, whisper it or using the voice, you know, do you want cookies or
broccoli
or broccoli. Ooh. Yeah, whatever goofy, exaggerated, more obvious thing you can do to help them really slow down and think about it before they say broccoli.
Yeah.
Not that we're bashing broccoli here, but you know,
yeah.
you want the pretty baby or the ugly baby.
You do not have an ugly baby that you play with, do you?
I have two ugly babies. I think she would be the scary baby.
Oh, we have so hit rock bottom today.
Oh, well, have we finished all of our topics? Oh, we're about done.
You yeah. know, we've got a lot more with questions, but I think we're going to just save those for next time when you and I are in a better frame of mind, and we can't really move on to this next one, too, without answering where questions. We'll start with that next time. But I do think, again, to hit the highlights with that receptive language problems, that answering questions and really understanding how to answer questions is often a big red flag that you've got more work to do with receptive language, that's still maybe even a bigger issue than expressive language when you have a kid who's still not answering those kinds of basic what's that, being able to make choices, or even answer a really simple where's question, or even yes, no. If you have a kid who's not doing that by 2.5, by 30 months, that's a sign that you've got a receptive language problem going on and that you're really going to need to work on that.
And it's not necessarily an easy thing to work on, but terribly important in the long run.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not easy. It's really not. I, again, can work myself into a frenzy sometimes thinking, how am I going to help him understand this? What kinds of examples can I do to make this real enough? Okay, so next week we'll pick up with this, with answering questions, and I want to thank Spike again for calling in. That was a fun call tonight, and we'd love to hear from anybody else next week. Join us next Thursday night, 6 o'clock Eastern Time, for Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.